So, good morning, everybody. Sorry I'm a few minutes late. I'm excited that you're here, and I'm ready to roll with the presentation. So, what I'd like to just start off by saying is happy Autism Awareness Day to everyone. I think this is an exciting webinar series that Chantel and Ernest have put together. Very exciting, and I'm honored to be a part of it. What I'd like to do is to hold sort of a bit of a Q&A at the end. So if you do have questions, please feel free to type them in and send them through, but I won't be looking at those until the end. So we'll try and get through what I think is going to be a great presentation. I put a lot of slides together here that we have to go through, and I will try and get through them in the time allotted. Okay, so the idea of this presentation is to talk about multi-treatment, obviously, and how do we design multi-treatment programs whereby you can pull together many different ideas, many different strategies into a cohesive whole. I came to this concept myself by working through many different programs and really just from learning from hundreds and hundreds of parents who themselves were going through this process. So what I'd like to do to start off with, just here is my agenda, is to talk about sort of the current experience of most families, which kind of leads us to a multi-treatment program, really. Then to look at what's on offer, what are the beliefs about what's on offer out there, and ultimately to work our way down into the multi-treatment model. Okay. Just for the sake of total openness, I do have a program called the Intensive Multi-Treatment Intervention Program. I work with a very limited number of families, but I am not here to talk about the IMTI model today really at all, but I'd like to just zero in on really what are the fundamentals of designing a multi-treatment program. Okay, so let's get into it here. The 2 million hits problem I talk about with families, and it sort of goes something like this. Anyone who's listening who is a parent rather than a professional will feel that this might be your own personal story. So you have a child and you realize something is different. And for some of you, it was really readily apparent, and for others of you, you might have had some sort of suspicion or just a question, and you started to begin a search. I have worked with families for whom that search spanned as many as 2 and even 3 years with professionals or doctors saying, hang on, let's wait and see. Or you might have been told it was one kind of challenge, but really it was something else, and ultimately you figured out it was autism either on your own or from a helpful professional years into your search. And along that search, during that time, you probably came across the idea of a spectrum, and we're starting to try and place your child somewhere on this autism spectrum. And once autism came, that word popped onto your screen, onto your radar, you probably Googled it and began to look, and up popped the 2 million links, and this is where I come up with the 2 million hits problem, because there your search really begins. That's where you really sit back and go, wow, what do we do? Where do we start? We now have a name and a label and an idea of what's going on for a child, but we have so many choices as parents. What do we do? What do we start with? So here's some choices that most of you will have come across, from play therapies to behavioral therapies, and lots of acronyms. You have the Relationship Development Intervention, Sunrise Program, you have Floor Time, ABA, Verbal Behavior Therapy, Vince Carbone. And we go right through the whole gamut from residential facilities, which aren't as popular these days, but are necessary in some cases, homeschooling, the whole biomedical side, and so on and so forth. So just incredible amount of choices. When we're talking about a multi-treatment program, we have to start to look at what are the choices out there and how do we start to choose, obviously. So what are some of the beliefs that many parents I work with come to the table, to the multi-treatment table with? Well, one of the first ones is that you should get on as many lists as you can, as early as possible, so you can start to get the treatments. Another one is that something that we're told often is that the behavioral treatment, ABA, for those of you in Canada listening, it'll be IBI, Intensive Behavioral Intervention, is really touted as the only scientifically based or proven. So that might limit other choices that you're looking at or confuse you because you've heard that belief. You might start to buy into that belief. And yet other professionals from other types of programs are telling you that they've seen really good progress in their treatment. So it brings up questions for you, contradictions. You've been told that because a main challenge for autism is the lack of being able to socialize or problems with socialization and communication, you've been told that a great thing for your child would be to be in social groups. And yet, for many of you, when your child has been put into social groups, the child didn't thrive. And so, again, you wonder, is this really helping my child? And then you've been told, probably, either really sold on doing something like a special diet, or you've had people tell you, don't do it, it didn't do anything for my child. So, again, a real sort of mix of perspectives that you've been told. Common individual treatment perspectives, and I want you to notice here on this side, it says, like the last one, that inhibit multi-treatment design. So in other words, these are perspectives that oftentimes, if you're working with a single treatment or one treatment, these are perspectives that get in the way of you really coordinating a fantastic multi-treatment perspective. So you may have been told by one professional, you know, we have the answers, we have what it takes to help your child. And at the same time, they may have told you others don't. You may have been told that their method, these other methods that you might be considering will get in the way of our method, and so on and so forth. So again, you might have been given information that inhibits you from working, coordinating programs together. Okay, let's go on to a common actions that parents take usually over this course of trying to help your child. Usually parents start by picking one treatment, and I put in there a pretty strong word, indoctrination. And I think I've been involved in this process way back when I began.
I'm listening to the most how different choices there are out there.
And that is that you start with one treatment, and this particular treatment program really convinces you that this is the way, it's the only way, it's going to work. And you kind of get indoctrinated. But after usually 6 months to a year, as a parent, you realize, well, the program is helping me, but I think I need some other things for my child. So you start picking a second, maybe even a third or a fourth treatment. And eventually you have this, what I would call a combo a la parent program. So as a family, you've really put together, maybe with the help of your local school as well, or a resource team, you put together this combination. But really it's the parents, and I want you to look at the bottom of this screen. It's the parents that are left to kind of coordinate these different programs, to negotiate and keep the peace between different professionals. I put a strong word in there to maybe even lie and maybe even feel guilty or confused about how do you can negotiate this. And I use that word. I know it's a strong word to lie, and I don't mean that in any bad way, but I've been told by many, many families that they're really often put in a hard place. For example, they want to do some behavioral intervention, and they recognize the need for play therapy at the same time, and yet the play therapist, people on their team are telling them not to do ABA, and the ABA people are telling them not to do any play therapy. And so the parents sometimes will even be in a situation where they can't speak honestly and openly between these professionals and teams about what they're really doing with the child. And I don't know if any of you listening today have been in that situation, but it seems like it's a very common situation. I don't think that's really fair at all for parents to be in that situation, but they often are. So I want to help you today with this. Okay, so here's a new perspective. It's the multi-treatment perspective. Okay, so here we go. I want to go to a slide that many of you have seen, and some of you surprisingly haven't. This is the DSM-4 criteria for autism, and I say surprisingly some of you haven't because I am surprised weekly when I work with a new family and I ask them the question, have you in fact seen the official criteria for autism, and many of them say no. So they don't really understand maybe fully how their child came to this diagnosis. And I'd encourage you, if you haven't seen this slide, or looked in the DSM-4, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Childhood Disorders, to go and take a look. And you can learn a bit more about it. But why I put this slide up here for multi-treatment is I want you just to take a look and see how broad-reaching this diagnosis is. So there's qualitative impairment in social interactions, in communication, stereotyped behavior, so behavioral challenges. Then we have delays or dysfunction in language, symbolic play, imagination, and so on and so forth. So it's really, really broad-reaching. And to that end, most of us on this call listening today will understand the idea that there is also within each of those domains, in the language, in the social, in the behavior, communication, there's a spectrum. And that each child that you might be here representing today can be somewhere on the spectrum in each of those categories. So you might have a child who's actually quite strong with language, but not with the social communication. Or a child who's actually quite funny and charming in different ways socially, and yet they have really quite stereotyped behaviors and need things to be done a certain way, and so on and so forth. So you could have strengths and challenges in different areas. So again, it's really all over the map. So to that end, I want to put up a slide that might interest you. This is a quote taken out of a report that was done by the National Research Council, the NRC. It's a bit old now, but it's still commonly cited. And this is a committee that was put together in the states, a congressional council, and they were asked to look at all of the treatments on autism in North America and kind of make a state of autism report. And here's what they concluded, that there is no single intervention that deals with all of the problems for autism. So this is a compelling underlying support for multi-treatment. Let's go to another one. This one might be more surprising to some of you. If you look at the bottom of this slide, you'll see that this is a quote from Ivar Lovaas. So this is Dr. Lovaas, the grandfather, or the father, if you will, of behavioral intervention. And this is a book some of you might be familiar with called the Me Book. And it's on the third page. So if you just flip on the inside cover, often a page that many people miss, really, because you're eager to get into the programming. And here we see that Lovaas says, I'm just going to highlight a couple of things. He says that there is no one approach which will solve all of the problems of these children. And then he goes on to say that the teacher, therapist, parent has to be flexible, innovative, and able to draw upon a variety of techniques and procedures. I find this statement fascinating in the context that many, many very strong proponents of ABA, which I am one of, by the way, I'm a strong proponent of behavioral techniques and use them very much in my own program, but there are many professionals who sort of talk about behavioral intervention as if it's the only thing that works or it's the only thing that should be done. And here is Lovaas himself saying that's actually not really accurate and it won't be working that way well at all if you do it that way. Here's just another little quote from Temple Grandin, who herself is also sort of very much in support of an integrated treatment approach of autism, of many things. Okay, so in conclusion of these first few slides, then here I'm suggesting that autism is multifactorial. So you have multi-symptoms, many different kinds of symptoms that we saw from that DSM-4 page. You have multi-causes, which I haven't gotten into much yet, but there's likely a genetic perspective, likely an environmental perspective, likely maybe a dietary issue. So it's just potentially multi-causes. And there are multi-treatments. So we have the autism puzzle. So here's my statement that I've made in the program that I teach and work with parents in, and that is that the underlying belief of the intensive multi-treatment intervention model is that the factors contributing to your child's behavior, communication, and learning challenges are multifaceted. Therefore, treatment should be multifaceted as well. Now, some of you listening this morning might be thinking, hey, I'm already doing a multi-treatment program. This seems to be not new news. And that's wonderful. And I hope that you'll get from what I'm going to get into, which are the principles of multi-treatment, still something that you could use in your programs. But for many, many families, and maybe many families listening this morning, they really are not coordinating programs effectively or efficiently as they could for their child. And that's where this presentation is going to go now. Okay, so here's some ideas of how you could start to structure multi-treatment maybe better for your child. The first thing that this slide is showing is what I call my inboxes, and that is if we go back to the idea of 2 million hits and all of the information that you would get from Google or books and research, I have a way of just kind of dividing up that information. And so these are just my little inboxes, if you will. So when I'm reading something about vitamin B12, that would go into the my biomedical treatment. If I'm reading something about craniosacral therapy, that would go into biomedical treatment. If I'm reading something about genetics or brain imaging, that would go into biomedical treatment. Regardless of whether I'm going to use that treatment or propose it to parents or recommend it, or if I think it's not valid and doesn't work, I still want to know and read about it, and it would go into that category. The next box is anything that would be really educational, and that's on the behavioral side, the cognitive side, emotional side, social side. So I call that my behavioral and cognitive education inbox. And in there would go play therapy, in there would go all of the behavioral therapies, in there would go occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, all of the different kind of educations that we would do. And then my third inbox is maybe particular to the treatment that I do, but I think it's incredibly important that families are supported, obviously, whether that's with respite, whether that's with counseling, whether that's with cheerleading and support, whether it's with hours in the home, finding ways to draw in family members and so on and so forth. So family and therapist, environment and attitudinal training. So how do we help families to remain strong and survive, if you will? Okay? So that's the IMJ, the multi-treatment sort of way that I arrange information right there. Okay. What I'd like to do next then is to go into principles of multi-treatment design. And I have 5 or 6 here that I'm going to go through for the presentation. And I think each of these could really be a discussion, but I'm going to kind of go through them and just present them for you. Let me just stop here for a moment and just say I came into the field of autism through, I had done a degree in psychology and also a master's in education. And I began doing play therapy. And during my time doing various kinds of play therapy, I saw many children benefit incredibly from that. It was very exciting to do that. But I also worked with a number of children for whom it was clear that they had biomedical issues, that they weren't well. They were sick, in fact. With bloated stomachs, some of them incredibly lethargic, just didn't seem to have the nutrition or the ability to digest the food well. Others, it seemed to me, and then it was confirmed by their doctor that they had some underlying seizure disorder, and so on and so forth. And to that end, no amount of play, no amount of really positive attitude, no amount of having lots of fun and having some good, solid cognitive activities to do with the children would help the children with these underlying physical disorders. And it was clear to me that play therapy alone wasn't going to move these children to a place where they would be able to function to their ability, if you will, to their underlying skills and the potentials that they had. And so I think that we needed to coordinate the play therapy with biomedical. But as I went along and began to do that, I also saw that many children came so far ahead that they needed something beyond play therapy to really get them ready for integration to school and to be able to function at higher levels. And that what they needed was that structure that a behavioral program or ABA would provide, some kind of structure of curriculum, some kind of structure of presentation of materials, and really benefiting and drawing upon a lot of the educational skills and strategies that I learned during my master's. And so it was this sort of journey of seeing that each different strategy and technique had something to offer that I wanted to draw in. And yet, I began to see that if we did it all at once, if I worked with a child and they weren't yet really physically well, but we were doing lots of play, and then we brought in structure, and if it was done at the wrong time and in the wrong order, that it simply didn't work that well at all. And this is what I see many families doing, is kind of just grabbing at everything they can, as I said in the beginning, getting on as many service lists as possible and coordinating as many things as you can find at once. What I find is many children are not able to thrive because there's so many different requests placed on them. In one program, they have to learn to do free play and planning. In another one, they have to follow instructions very well. Another one, they have to adjust maybe to certain other kinds of therapies and demands. And it just seems discombobulating. So here's some principles that you could follow to make this work easier. The first one, and I've had it up on here for a while, so maybe you've read it. I'm just going to go through it. Is that if the diagnosis of autism is multifactorial, as I said before, then the treatment should be multifaceted. So we'd want to develop and apply an expanding functional behavioral analysis. And what that means is, as you're looking at what your child's needs are, we want to try and understand for each of their challenges if we should be looking in the biomedical category or an educational category, if there's something maybe more familial in the family environment. Okay, so in other words, if a child is incredibly hyperactive and you're a proponent of the behavioral intervention model, you may start to put in different kinds of reinforcers and different kinds of consequences in place to decrease that hyperactivity. But I might come along and suggest to you, well, wait a minute, let's look at a deeper sort of functional behavioral analysis. Let's go further than just an assessment and see if maybe there's an underlying biomedical cause that we'd want to consider. That might be driving the hyperactivity. Maybe there's an allergy. Maybe this child is getting some foods that he shouldn't be having. Or, in fact, maybe he's missing some kind of nutrition that he needs. Maybe there's something in the environment that's setting off this hyperactivity that has nothing to do with diet, but might have to do with a certain kind of sound that's in the house and so on and so forth. And so all of a sudden, we've taken one behavior and we're already starting to look at it through a multi-treatment lens, not just from one angle, but from a diverse perspective, okay? And this is important as you go on, as you read websites, as you talk to professionals. For example, if you have a colicky child, a child who's not sleeping well, and you talk to one professional who is a play therapist, they might suggest to you one strategy through their play therapy lens. If you talk to an occupational therapist about the sleep challenge, they're going to give you another idea through their occupational therapy lens. And this is what's sort of confusing, obviously, for parents, is to pick and choose, well, who am I going to listen to and what should I try? And I'm not here to give you the clear answer for your child with a sleeping challenge, but the idea is for you to remain open to consider all of those possibilities. I am going to give you in this presentation, though, an order of a way in which you might think these things through. So let's go to slide number 2 here. So learning is a biological process, and this is one of the first things that I'm going to suggest to you, is that for any challenge that your child has, any behavioral challenge, any cognitive challenge, emotional challenge, I encourage parents to first and foremost make sure that the child is as healthy as possible. So whether you're a big Defeat Autism Now, Dan proponent, or maybe you're not, whether you believe that vaccines do in fact cause autism or not, whether you're a proponent of special diets or not, I'm not here to take a stand in any one of those today, but I do believe it's important, as I said here, that a child needs to be healthy to play and ready, therefore ready to learn. There are many, many, many of our children on the autism spectrum who are simply just not well. There's underlying biomedical issues that we need to solve. And sitting them in a chair and having them try and learn at a table doing sorting tasks, you know, for hours at a day if they have intense headaches or if their eyes are bothering them or if they're feeling not well in their digestion or if they're incredibly constipated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It just seems to me almost not fair in some way. And I'm not saying that to criticize people who are doing their very best to help these children, but maybe just that we need to back up for a moment and consider the physical health as much as possible of these children. So another way to say this is if you have a child going, for example, to a soccer practice, maybe some of you have your child enrolled in soccer or t-ball, some kind of a sport like that, swimming lessons, is for you to stop for a moment and ask yourself, does my child have the physical, the physicality, the physical ability, and I don't mean the coordination skills, but the underlying health to be able to achieve and do well in this activity, and try and answer that maybe in conjunction with a professional, a medical doctor, naturopathic doctor, whoever is your sort of health provider. Okay, so that's really important. And by the way, obviously a teacher in a school, and maybe a play therapist, maybe an occupational therapist, a speech and language therapist, they may not have the insights based on their training, their specific, highly specialized training. They may not have the insights to answer that question for you. And so that's where bringing in a doctor who has insights into that can really help. Okay. For anyone that's still sort of wondering about how important the biology is and the physical health, I just sort of thought I'd throw this slide in to make a clear statement that learning, in order for your child to learn, it is a biological process. As much as we talk about psychology and cognition, the cognitive process, it's all a biological process. So information has to come in, the sensory input, and then you have to process it. That's also a biological process that's happening with your neurology, your nerves in your body. And you can look at a nerve. It's made of a myelin sheath, so there's your fatty acids. And you have to have potassium in order for an axon potential to happen. So this is all sort of biology. But what I'm getting at is in order for that behavioral output to happen correctly, in order for a child to sit and focus, in order for a child to reach out and point to the duck on the page or the umbrella on the page, the biology really has to be able to function and work. And this is an important thing. I was at a conference here in Toronto where I am last year and sat through a very interesting presentation on subclinical seizure disorder. And how many children they seem to as many as 20-25% of the children on the spectrum are having subclinical seizures that are not otherwise detected unless you do sort of a 24-hour sleep deprivation measure and so on and so forth. But again, it was just an example of how many undetected things may be happening for these children. Okay, so number three, principles for multi-treatment design. While the development of children with autism does not follow a neurotypical development, the order of development and age-appropriate steps should be considered. So what I'm saying here is there are developmental charts that your pediatrician uses to determine whether your child is delayed or advanced, right? So children begin to walk at X age, and if your child is not yet walking and still crawling, then we might see that they're delayed. So there's developmental milestones that as parents you'll be familiar with, and you may have even seen charts yourself. As an educator, as a treatment specialist in the field of autism, one of the most challenging things is that there doesn't exist a development chart for the population of children and people with autism. In other words, there's no consensus that all children with autism at the age of three are walking or not walking. The development is often all over the map, if you will. It's scattered. It's variable. And so what we tend to do is to follow a lot of play therapists or developmental psychologists. That's my background is developmental psychology, is we tend to follow a neurotypical or normal development charts and gauge a child with autism against that. Whether that's fair or not is the debate, but that's how we tend to do it. Other programs, some behavioral programs, for example, may sort of cherry-pick or select off of a developmental chart what they feel are the main skills that a child needs to learn to move forward. And it's not necessarily a complete picture of development, but they might say a child has to be able to sit at a desk, a child has to be able to imitate behavior, they have to be able to obviously feed themselves, so their self-help skills, use a fork and a spoon. But it's really kind of made up, if you will, for that special population. What I want to suggest to you here is that you should really sit back and consider what objectives you're wanting your child to learn today. So if you, after this talk, later this afternoon or maybe tomorrow, if you sat down and across all the programming that your child is getting, okay, so if you wrote at the top of your page school, if your child's in school, and then you wrote play, you know, a peer play program if they're in a social program, and then you wrote down speech and language therapy, and then you wrote down sports if they're in a sport, and if you wrote down all those programs and identified the objectives, the actual learning objectives that you're asking your child to learn right now across all of those, then what I would do with you is I'd sit down and look at that and say, okay, are these appropriate, meaning in terms of are they coordinating with each other? So in one program, for example, you might be asking your child to have more independence in school, and so if they need to go to the washroom, the teacher really wants them to go and get, a piece of paper or a little token that the person who's going to the bathroom holds, and then go down the hall and take themselves to the bathroom and come back. So it's all about independence and needing to go. Whereas in another program, they may want the child to put up their hand and ask first, and have to communicate that skill and maybe only go with a buddy down to the washroom or something. And so it's not about independence, but it's about communication and following a certain schedule or something. And so there we would see that the child is being asked to do really two different functions around the same objective of going to the washroom. And we have to see, are they coordinated? Are they confusing for the child? Are those two objectives supporting each other or counseling each other out, and so on and so forth. So that would be one way that we would look across the objectives is, are they coordinated? Do they make sense to go together? Another way to look at this is in terms of the way in which the objectives are done. So maybe in one program, that particular objective is being done through play. In another, it's being done through structure. In another, the reinforcer is food or a video. In another one, there is no reinforcement like that. So again, that consistency across the design of the programming is really, really, really critical for you to look at and consider. Okay? So that would be principle number three, is that you make sure that they're age appropriate. At least you should consider that. And if the order of development makes sense as well for your child. By the way, there's many, if you've never seen a development chart, there's many that you could access in books from the library and developmental psychology books. You may ask your pediatrician for one. They may have a chart that they could lend you or give to you or online. And I'd also recommend for any of you who are doing any kind of homeschooling programming, you may want to look at the Hawaii Early Learning Profile. The acronym is HELP, Hawaii Early Learning Profile, and it's by a company called the Vort Corporation, V-O-R-T, and they have sort of developmental charts that you can get, and you can go through and kind of follow your child's development. They're neurotypically developed, and so you sort of compare your child to what would be sort of considered to be normal development within certain ranges. But I use the health chart sometimes to great benefit. Okay, just want to, again, given the last principle, I want to give you an idea of something that I do then in the IMTI program, the Intensive Multi-Treatment Intervention Program. I really go through sort of six phases. And what I want to point out here, again, thinking about order of development, is I believe that, for example, if you look at ABA or IBI, okay, if you look at the sort of the behavioral programs, they're highly structured. The curriculum is highly well-defined. A lot of the work is at the table, although not limited to the table work. And there's no doubt, there's no question that these programs are very beneficial for most of the children on the spectrum and that kids get great benefit from it. However, and this is the however, I believe that there are skills that a child needs to develop such that they could benefit greatly from this structure and from that kind of curricular, highly adult-led, structured curriculum. And that is to be able to have and form a relationship with the instructor, to be able to do the skills like imitation, like attention span or having joint attention, and really having a will to come to learn. A lot of therapists and parents will agree that it's often quite a struggle to get your child to learn without having to use great lists of motivators like videos and candies and free play time and that kind of stuff, which is very much part of ABA. In the IMTI program that I teach, we rarely use anything but kind of cheering on a child, celebrating and doing high fives. In other words, we don't have to have a lot of lists of motivators as reinforcers, if you will. But the reason is, not magic, but the reason is because we spend phase one and phase two doing play therapy. Okay? So phase one and phase two would be really building rapport, getting social reinforcement going around the eye contact, the language, sharing, taking turns, imitation skills, really what you might think of as studentship skills. Once that's established in phase one and phase two, and that can take anywhere from 3 months right up to 6 months or a year even in some cases. So it's not sort of just the first 2 or 3 weeks of, creating a bit of a relationship, but it's really going through a whole complement of social skills. Once that's in place, then we go to a very structured, curriculum-based, mostly at the table, adult-led, almost ABA-ish, if you will, phase three, and that can last quite a while too. And that's where we do a lot of catch-up. That's where we do a lot of bringing the child up to speed in terms of curriculum, ABCs, 1, 2, 3, colors, numbers, a sorting test, all of that sort of cognitive development, as well as language, a lot in there. Now, if you take a look, though, on the screen, you'll see the next one says Introduction to Peers and Playdates, and that's interesting because it's in phase four. It's not really early on. And again, if we look at neurotypical development, if we look at the development of most children, in order to interact with your peers, in order to do that parallel play in the sandbox or the water table at school, or in order to sit in a desk beside another peer and learn from them and benefit from that incredibly rich social environment that you're often sold on by a child psychologist, you know, put your child in this rich social environment. In order to benefit from that environment, your child has to have a lot of skills. They have to be able to look. They have to be able to imitate. They have to be able to want to be there. They have to be able to listen. And so I don't introduce the play dates and the peers until after some of that structured curriculum has happened, just with adults, until after the relationship building has happened. Phase one and phase two, by the way, is done with adults. So the peers come into phase four. And then we transition into public environments and ultimately school. So that just gives you one model, one idea of how you might structure multi-treatment design. I'm going on to a new screen now. And this is just a simple statement, yet I think an effective one, and that I don't advocate that you pull things in all at once. Okay, so a really big sort of underlying point I'm trying to make in this presentation is that multi-treatment doesn't mean get all the services you can all at once and just kind of pull them together, and it's just about fitting them into the hours of the week, but it's more about what's appropriate now and that it's okay to put things on pause and not quite do something yet until your child has one skill in order to be able to benefit from the next, for example. Okay? So number five, don't look to one treatment strategy for the entire length of your child's development. Play therapy may be appropriate for the first year of your child's programming. He may feel, you know, he's not quite ready to sit at a table yet. He's not quite ready for that hardcore learning. But after 6 months or a year, you might say, you know, I think we're kind of done with this play therapy. I think we need to sort of move on to some more structure now, or my child could really now start to benefit from some more guidance and some more sort of defined curriculum. So I will make a statement that I'm not an advocate for most children of a parent picking one singular individual style or type of programming and sticking with that for sort of 3 or 4 years, as some parents do. There's certainly ongoing development, but the question is, could you achieve a much greater level of development if you highly customized it and didn't attach yourself to one program? So I'll just read the last little bit of this slide. It says, each child's needs change over time. It's a bit of a moving target. And so a multi-treatment program, in its very essence, evolves as each new strength and challenge becomes apparent. It evolves. And it evolves meaning that the program, with the coordinator, the parent, stays open to the idea that different and maybe even sometimes opposing approaches may be needed at various times. Okay? So we'll go down. We're getting near to the last few here, and then we'll have some time for a Q&A. So number six, each individual treatment and strategy should be chosen based on your child's specific needs. So we talked about that. That's almost an obvious one, and hopefully you're already doing that. But also, you want to choose each strategy. So that means whether it's speech and language therapy or whether it's Vince Carbone verbal behavior therapy. You're picking those also insofar as their complementarity, how they complement other parts of your treatment program. And that's what I was talking about earlier on, to look across the programming and see how do these various treatments sort of coordinate with each other. And not just because it worked for another child, okay? And here's a list. But if any of you want to get this list, you can certainly contact me and I can send it to you. But here's a list of questions that would be really good to ask. And I just want to highlight a few here. One question, if you look down number three, it says, who does this strategy or therapy work best for and who doesn't it work well for? And if you're working with a professional who's been in the field for many years, and I think if they're honest, they'll be able to identify who it works for. Beware of therapists or therapies that tell you it works for all kids all the time. Beware of that, because I simply don't think that's true. As we saw from the earlier slides, both Ivar Lovas and the NRC identified that there isn't one therapy that works for all behaviors for all kids. So they should be able to articulate that for you. Here's another question I just want to highlight, and it's in terms of the timing. By the way, if you look down, I sort of use W questions, what, who, which, when. This when is a timing. You might say to a music therapist, for example, when should I include this in my child's development and therapy? When? And when should I not? Is there a time in development, an age, a level of development, or a time when other programs are going on that this might conflict instead of being complementary? Maybe it would conflict with something else we're doing. I'll often say to a family, you know what, given that your child is in full-time school right now with already some sports and some, you know, reading, let's say remedial reading programming happening after school, is already really full. It doesn't seem like your child has a lot of rest time. So right now wouldn't be a good time to work with me because I'm just going to give you another 20 things that I want you to be doing with your child. So why don't you wait until the summer and in, you know, June, let's talk and see if we can do some stuff for the summer. So I'm really often the person telling the parent, don't work with me now. It's not a great time for you. So again, beware of people that are willing just to sort of take you on board and start whenever, whatever, just because you're the next client. I think that's an important thing to look at. Okay? All right, number seven, we're almost done here. Successful multi-treatment must have a central command. And I think this is a really key thing I want to underline. It's a longer discussion for many families, which is, well, who would that be? This is a role that I fulfill, obviously, for my clients. But it's hard to find a therapist out there who is open to many different ideas and understands how to coordinate these. But if it's you as a parent, I think that there should be one single coordinator. You have to have buy-in from all therapists. So if you're a family listening right now and you have a behavioral therapy in place and you're doing some play therapy or social group work, and let's say you're doing something else like occupational therapy or speech therapy, I want to strongly encourage you to sit these people down at some point for an hour meeting and have them talk to each other and really be open with each other about those questions that I just listed there for them to say in front of the other people, what does their program attempt to do and what can't it cover? where are their strengths, what are the strategies they're using, and so that you begin to coordinate a program for your child, where your child feels that there's consistency across environments and not differences. I wrote about this idea in an article that I had printed in the Autism File, the magazine, the Autism File, that many of you might know about, and it was last year. The article is available on my website at imti.ca, so you can take a look at that article if you'd like. But I talk about the importance of consistency across environments like that. So total buy-in, you need great communication systems between these programs, and you need accountability as well. In other words, if one therapist says that they're doing something, to make sure that they really are doing that and not something different. And if they change, that they communicate that. Okay? So those are the principles. I know we have about 10 minutes left here that we can do some Q&A with. This is a slide if any of you are interested up on YouTube. If you search IMTI and autism, there are some videos that I have there of some of the families that I've worked with where I talk more about multi-treatment and also the coordination between sort of the biomedical piece and moving forward from there. So you may want to go there. Or the videos are also available and information at imta.ca. So there's that. Okay? Okay, here's some questions. Sorry, I've got them now. Okay, so Kimberly Bunce. Right, yes. Again, we're back to that question. So how do you know what type of treatments? I've talked about coordinating treatments, talked about maybe some ideas of how to do that. But how do you know which actually ones do you pick? Well, that's a great question, and that's entirely specific to each child. And so what I would do with any given child is do a bunch of testing. It's basically a baseline. So where is your child at? Okay. And then for each individual thing here, it's mentioned about eating skills. Okay. So the child's worked with an OT, a speech therapist, and so on and so forth, and you made little progress. Any suggestions? Sure. So with eating, the very first thing I always do is go to biology. So I look at, are the structures in place for a child to be able to actually eat, like chewing, like swallowing? I'll give you an example. I worked with autistic twins here in Ontario, and one of them at one point had limited eating, and it took quite a while for us to figure out that the child was having some acid reflux happening, so indigestion happening, and what the result of that was that the esophagus was mildly inflamed such that it was uncomfortable for the child to eat. And so actually it wasn't a picky eating, if you will, disorder or challenge with chewing or something like that, but it was more an indigestion problem. Once we were able to identify that, the child had some antacid prescription and some anti-inflammation prescription as well. That really helped with the esophagus returning back to normal functioning, and the child was happily eating. Give you another example, though. I worked with a child who was nonverbal, an older child, as it turns out, and really resisted having her teeth brushed or brushing her teeth, and as a result, didn't have great oral hygiene, and was also starting to self-limit and be, if you'd call it, a picky eater. And interesting, it's mentioned here in the email, smaller bites. This is a case for this child. What we recognize in taking this child to this sort of specialist dentist is that she had several cavities and that it was probably quite painful for the child to be eating food and chewing much. And so this particular young adult, if you will, in her teens, wasn't eating that much. But again, it wasn't really an eating problem, but an oral hygiene problem. Once we filled the fillings or filled the cavities, her appetite really came back in terms of the amount of food that she put in her mouth and chew and so on and so forth. So these aren't easy. This isn't true for all children, you know, that they have acid reflux or cavities if they're not eating well. But it's an example of how you can begin to check out and make sure at least that there's a proper bit, that all the faculties are there, all the biological processes for eating are in place. Once you can check that off, then we go to the environment and we start saying, okay, what's mealtime like for this child? Is it an enjoyable experience or is it a hardcore, intense sort of behavioral process? Is it a social process that a child wants to be at or not? Are there sounds in the kitchen? Are there smells in the kitchen that don't work for that child? Maybe we need to adjust the environment, put on an exhaust fan earlier and get rid of some of the smells in order for eating to happen. So we look at the environment, and then from there, then we go to behavior and communication. So I hope that helps you with some ideas, Kimberly, to think about. One from Portland, how do you negotiate treatment with modalities that you disagree with? Wow, that's a great question. I guess the question I'd ask is, what exactly do you disagree with? And if you disagree with a modality, why would you pursue it? And you may have a very good answer. I'm not saying that in a judgmental way, but really in an honest question way of, you know, why pursue something that you disagree with? I believe really strongly in parent intuition and feelings. When I say I believe strongly, I think parents should be listened to. And I think that if you have a strong intuition that something's not working, it's usually backed up by observation that you might not be trusting. So find a professional that will listen to you in terms of at least your observations and work with you in talking it through. I'd also say to this mother in Portland asking the question, talk directly with your with the treatment provider. So if you agree or disagree with some of the things that this treatment provider is doing, you need to be vocal about it. Sit down. You don't have to be confrontive, but just sit down and talk about it. I invite ongoingly for families that I work with to give me feedback. Tell me if you're comfortable with this or not comfortable. And there's sometimes when I want to do a certain kind of strategy or introduce a certain activity that the parents don't want right now. So I need to respect that. But sometimes it's also a matter of education, meaning that I might have some insight or experience of a particular strategy that the parent isn't yet informed about. And if they were informed and have that information, they may see it from a different perspective. And vice versa. There's often information that I don't know about a child that I can gain from the parents that would help to re-inform my sort of programming design. So all of that to say to the mom in Portland that back and forth communication is really, really critical that you're honest and just upfront about it.